Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
I think a lot of you are a bit taken aback at what seems to be a very high Garda activity up in Donegal. I'm wondering why is that not happening in Dublin? McKay says, why are Gardaí persecuting the people of Donegal and not as active in Dublin? Same old story. But Moira in Dublin 15, and I go along 100% with this one, Moira. I live in one of the Dublin areas with a high incidence of COVID. It's shocking how many teens and young adults are congregating regularly night and day. No Gardaí to be seen anywhere. Moira, we don't want to just blame the young people. I think there's people congregating all over the gaff, and there isn't a guard to be seen, and nobody's saying a word to them, and it's not just young people. Now, I'm joined now by someone who is probably going to have a huge bearing on our lives in the next while, and maybe also he can give us some idea of where he thinks everything is going in the bigger picture. Gabriel McClough, Governor of the Central Bank, you're very welcome.
Good morning.
Before we get on to the more pressing matters, you're back in Ireland now, but you had a kind of an interesting time during the lockdown, in the sense that you were, for a good chunk of it, you were governing the central bank from Greece. Tell us about that.
Indeed. It was, I remember the day very clearly, because the 12th of March, I was in a meeting at the ECB in Frankfurt, and my wife and I had decided to go to Athens to spend the weekend with my mother. It was just before St. Patrick's Day. So we're going to have a long weekend. We flew on that Thursday to Athens. And on the Friday afternoon, two things happened. The announcement was made that schools were going to be closed. And we made a decision that all the central bank staff would work from home. And at the same time, my mother was rushed to hospital. And she was 95 then, she's 96 now. So I found myself starting the period of lockdown, not only in Greece, but with my mum in intensive care. So it was a pretty, you said, Brendan, you called it interesting. It was certainly stressful.
What was the situation like in the hospital in Greece? We'd have a picture that it can sometimes be quite chaotic in the Greek hospitals.
Well, it was actually very organised. Everyone was wearing masks. Entry into the hospital was controlled, so you couldn't just sort of wander in. There was security at the door. And it was very organised. But to be honest, at the time I wasn't paying that much attention as to how everything was working in those first few days, but she spent a month in hospital. And I was starting my day going to visit her, ending my day visiting her, and then spending the time in between at meetings running the central bank. I mean, everybody was working remotely.
And how long did that go on for?
She was in hospital for a month.
And how long were you in Greece?
And I was in Greece for nearly 3 months.
Were you effectively stuck there at a certain point?
Well, I mean, I was stuck there for the first month to... Well, for the first couple of months, I was stuck there because she wasn't well. And it was, you know, my responsibility to look after her. But then once we got some... she's now at home and she's better. But she now has 24 hours care. So once we'd sorted the care out, it was easy to come back and to carry on working remotely from here. You know, it's been remote working for 6 months with the odd visit to the office in that
time.
And
is that working out well for you and the central bank staff?
It's worked remarkably well in the sense that... you know, people worked incredibly hard at the beginning to make sure the IT systems worked, and everybody just got, I think everyone across the country were probably working at 150% to manage the crisis. That's carried on. But as I think the longer it goes on, the more we're missing going into the office. But we are working like everybody, you know, across the world. My preference would be to be in the office, to be absolutely honest with you. But otherwise, it's working well. We're getting used to the positives and the downsides of working from home. The positives, I think a lot of people have got more flexibility in their lives. The negatives are you're spending too much on time on video calls, which interestingly, and I wouldn't have said this at the beginning, it's quite tough. It's quite hard to concentrate. It is what it is, and we just have to get used to it.
In terms of how you ended up here, because you're the first non-Irish person to be governor of the central bank here, I think, aren't you?
Apparently.
I believe your wife played a part in you ending up in Ireland.
Well, she did. We went to... So we were living in the UK, and decided to go to New Zealand. I was offered a job in New Zealand, and we said we'd go for 3 years. And the 3 years turned into nine. And at the end of that, she said to me she'd like to come back to Europe. But she'd put up with me being 12 hours away from London, if it had to, you know, if I had to get a job outside. So we came back to Europe, and we're only an hour away from London. So that was an important draw.
Now, between New Zealand and Ireland, there was a bit of a hiccup in terms of the ending of your career there and kind of the beginning of it here. Just explain to us what happened there.
Oh, well, it was in my last month. My last month of...
You're nearly out the door.
Nearly out the door. Last month of the 9 years, I was running the Treasury, and we had a leak of information of budget information. It transpired that our website had a weakness in it, and someone with patience managed to access it and access information. I complained loudly about this, and with hindsight, complained too loudly. It created a lot of noise. There was an inquiry as to my behaviour. In the end, I got cleared. I got told I was acting in good faith.
It was harsh enough, wasn't it? The State Services Commission chief said, "I've concluded Mr. McClough failed to take personal responsibility for the Treasury security failure. His subsequent handling of the situation fell well short of my expectations. He's accountable for that, and I'm calling it out." I presume in terms of central bank and economists speak, that's quite a rap on the knuckles.
That was his view, absolutely, is a rap on the knuckles. Mm. And I accepted responsibility for
it.
I mean, the report itself, Brendan, just to be clear, the report itself basically said I acted in good faith. And
absolutely.
But I took responsibility for it. And
does that rattle you personally? Presumably reputation is all in the business you're in.
Yeah.
Does that kind of thing rattle you when something like that happens?
Well,
you were acting in good faith.
Nobody
but
wanted
it's a blot.
I mean, no one would have wanted that in any sort of circumstances. That sort of not just the incident, but just the whole sort of public the public debate about you as an individual and the criticism. It affected my family as much as me. So no one would have wanted it to happen. But, you know, in the end, you've got to stand by your values, and you've got to do the things that you believe are right. And I've been a career public servant. Honesty, integrity, objectivity, impartiality, that's at the core of the way I work. And when you're in leadership positions, sometimes you make mistakes and you have to put your hand up. You own them, you fix them, you learn from them. And
if only all leaders did that when they made a mistake. Well, but anyway, did you know Ireland well before you came here?
I know it a lot better than when I came here. And I hesitate to say I knew it well. I'd been before a lot of it. I mean, well, most of it, if not all of it, for work. I had Irish friends. Probably knew a little bit more about Irish history than most people who go to school in England. I went to a Christian Brothers school.
Okay.
In England. But I didn't. I mean, actually, I spent the summer holidays, the break between New Zealand and here, I spent most of it in the Greek islands. just resting. And I read J.J. Lee's History of Ireland in the 1912 to 1985, and that was certainly definitely worth doing.
And I believe, and you probably learned more doing this, you took a staycation around the country this summer. What did you observe on your staycation?
Well, we did a circle. We did a circle of the island. So we went from Dublin down to the bottom of Wexford, across to Cork, West Cork, Killarney, Galway, Connemara, Donegal and back. Always, incidentally, by some miracle, ahead of the bad weather. So wherever we went, it was nice. And when we left it, sort of bad weather came. So we went to Mediterranean beach in Connemara, which is one of my highlights. What did I observe? We observed, because it was my wife and I did this, we observed a lot of history.
In terms, though, of how things are
I was just going to come on to it. The thing that struck me in particular was how busy everything was. It was. I don't know whether it's in the past it's busier, because obviously I haven't travelled around, but it was busy.
So you were obviously out in that wind, that brief window of freedom.
Well, yeah, but I think everybody was out. Yeah. I remember we went into one evening. We went into Killarney, and actually we were a bit perturbed by just the sheer number of people. It was a Saturday night, admittedly, but the sheer numbers of people was a bit concerning for us.
Yeah. It all worked out fine anyway. The COVID is going through the roof now after it. You have said that, excuse me, the consequences of a second full lockdown would be very, very serious. And I think there is concern now that we could be heading to that. I see a mention today in one of the papers of the idea of this circuit breaker that they're talking about in the UK, that we would shut down completely, possibly over the midterm break at the end of October. How bad would the damage be if we have to shut down again?
Well, I think it would be very serious. We saw the shutdown at the beginning of the pandemic, the March-April period, and into the beginning of May, that took us, that's been the lowest point of economic activity this year. Things have got better since then. So essentially, if we're going to go back to a big lockdown, we're going to go back to the sort of world that we were in April, where businesses were hit in a big way, job losses were hit in a big way, households were hit in a big way and helped by, you know, the numbers of people that had asked for payment breaks on their mortgages. I think was just a sign. Things have got better since then. And a full lockdown, partly because I think It would, apart from stopping economic activity, I think it would have a very, very big impact on confidence, on people's confidence in the future, actually on people's mental well-being. I think one of the issues of the moment is people's mental well-being, and I think we need, as a community, to think very hard about that.
Should someone like you be on NPHET?
Well, I don't know whether NPHET needs a central bank governor. I think
Do they need input from people like you, though?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they're the health people. They're the public health people. And we absolutely need the public health people to do their job. And I think they're doing their job. And I'm pretty sure
they're solely public health focused. Do you think it needs to be a solely public health focus?
Well, the decisions ultimately that are made are decisions made by government. See, NPHET advises, there's now a new committee of senior officials.
Who are, as far as we know so far, haven't queried or changed anything.
Yeah, I don't know what they've done. But it's the government makes the decisions, and it's the government itself which needs to take into account the various public health and economic aspects.
So you've modelled in the central bank a severe scenario way back. I presume we're in that severe scenario now, are we? I suppose what we were hoping, the benign scenario was a V shape where we dealt with this thing and things bounced back again. But now, like, we're being, it's kind of death by a thousand cuts now, isn't it?
Not quite. I mean, I've never been a believer in a V shape, because it always seemed to me that it was more likely to be a sort of Nike swoosh. There'd be a sharp fall, but then a gradual recovery. And that is actually what we're seeing right now. The severe scenario that we were modelling assumed that there'd be a second lockdown, full lockdown, which we're not in. So I think we're still in a variant of the benign scenario. We're going to, in the next 10 days, we're going to publish our latest forecasts for the economy. And what we have seen over the past few months, because the rules have been relaxed, is we have seen a recovery. As I said earlier, things were at their lowest in April. They're better. But the fact that we've got some of these lockdowns in parts of the country certainly isn't helping. Things are better than they were.
So a couple of specifics on it then. The central bank, I know, is broadly supportive, as most economists are, of the massive borrowing and the massive spending the government is doing right now. Mm-hmm. But you also say that a path to lower and more sustainable levels will eventually have to be taken. Does that mean that you think we need to be looking at some form of austerity in the next, maybe in 2-3 years' time?
No, I don't. I think if we plan this and manage this well, and at the moment I think overall it is being managed well, we can avoid the sort of austerity that we had when after the last crisis. I think we can avoid that. The point I have made before is that at some point, I mean, right now the actions for the government to borrow, what the government's doing, actually, they're absolutely necessary and they're affordable. But at some point, we are going to have to put the government's own books into a better in better order. If we focus on protecting the productive capacity of the economy, we can actually use growth to address this extra debt, as opposed to having to use austerity.
Okay, and when you say focus on the productive capacity, you have said that within that, that these supports, the government supports, need to be targeted. You essentially think that a time is coming now where we need to start pulling the plug on businesses that aren't viable.
I'd put it the other way, actually. I think we absolutely need to focus on businesses that would be viable were it not for the pandemic, were it not for the lockdown and all the restrictions.
Okay, so you're putting it in a more positive frame.
What you are saying
is that the ones that are not viable, we need to start, the government, banks, whoever, needs to start making that distinction, yes?
I am saying that it's important. I mean, one of the most worrying things from an economic perspective right now is that the effect of the pandemic leads to what economists call scarring effects. And by scarring effects, I mean like long-term unemployment, by people losing attachment to the labour force, by people losing their skills, by people needing, training, etc. We want to avoid those scarring effects, and focusing on that should be the priority. And there are many businesses out there right now, in particular SMEs, that actually would be viable were it not for the pandemic. And we need to focus on supporting them, helping them to get through this.
And not support the others.
Well, at the end of the day, there are limited resources in the state, and the priority needs to be, there are almost certainly businesses which at the beginning of, before the pandemic, weren't particularly viable. And the pandemic's going to make it really hard for them to become viable. And I think when you've got limited resources, the government needs to ask itself, where should it focus? How should it prioritize? And my advice to the government is it needs to prioritize and support viable businesses.
Yeah, you see, I know you're not trying to win any popularity contests, but right now, you with your concern for mental health and everything, you can see how it's hard for people to hear that. It's hard for some guy or woman who struggled through the lockdown, wondering if they were going to survive, what their future is, getting back on their feet now. And not to be smart about it, but being told by a career civil servant who has never really taken a risk or set up a business, who had the luxury of spending lockdown in Greece, minding your mother and working remotely, running the central bank in a fine job. That's what people are going to think. Who is this guy to tell me that my life, my business that I put everything into, should not be supported at this time because somebody deems it not viable? Can you see how that's difficult?
No, I can completely. And I think if you've, and I completely sympathise and empathise with the fact that there are many businesses who are viable, but are struggling because of the pandemic. And I think they need to be supported. That's my point. They absolutely need to be supported. They need to be helped through the way I've described it or thought about it is that government's role is to provide a bridge for businesses and households from the sort of world that we were in before the pandemic through this pandemic and out the other end. And government does, at the end of the day, it doesn't have unlimited resources. I mean, not just financial ones, just sort of capacity ones to support. And helping those businesses that are only struggling because of the lockdown is actually a top priority.
That's my point. Another thing that's on people's mind is that obviously a lot of the payment breaks and mortgage breaks are coming to an end now. But obviously this crisis is not coming to an end and people's income, it can still be uncertain and very damaged and everything. Should the banks not now extend and keep supporting people, give it another 3 months and let the reckoning that's going to happen on people's mortgages and on their small business owners kick that reckoning out a bit?
No, I think what probably, so what we've had actually is a significant number of people have gone back to normal payment arrangements, but certainly there are people who are still on payment breaks. I think what's important is that if borrowers have got see themselves still in difficulty in terms of repaying their loan, the top priority should be that they contact their lender and start having a conversation early about the challenges they have. And I think that the lenders need to start thinking very hard about the individual's particular circumstances and how to support them. So they can, banks can, lenders can allow for more payment breaks. There's nothing stopping them in the system.
But do you think they should?
I think what they should do, if a borrower turns up and says, I've got a particular problem, I absolutely think they should look at that borrower's circumstances and think what needs to be done to support because it's both in the borrower and the lender's interests. What I think the world that is a bit different from where we've been is that in terms of having these general system-wide breaks, I think we now need to start tailoring them more to an individual's circumstances.
Do you think people in this country will trust the banks to do that? Have you observed, coming from the outside, have you observed trust between the people of this country and the banks, between people of this country and the central bank?
Well, I've certainly observed non-trust with the banks. There's definitely an issue, which the banks themselves, to do them credit, recognise because they've set up their culture board because they realise they've got a problem. And they'd absolutely need to continue to work on that problem of theirs.
Hang on. The banks don't all realise they have a problem. What about what could only be called that gangsterism from KBC on the tracker mortgages. After the central bank came in and was investigating it,
yep.
they lied and evaded right up to the end. They continued processes that meant people lost their homes long after they'd been caught, essentially, and basically did kind of lie and obfuscate to the central bank, didn't they?
Which is why they were fined 18 million plus euro. And absolutely, I think their behaviour was unconscionable. And that's the sort of thing that they need to address. Because
what does it say about the central bank as a regulator as well, that yep. their fear of the central bank was such that they didn't even bother playing ball with the investigation and they continued with the nefarious practices?
I suspect they've probably learned from their 18 million euro fine. I think certainly the central bank has addressed the issues of 10 years ago in the financial crisis. We have we absolutely made mistakes at the last financial crisis. We're not in a financial crisis now. We're in a different sort of crisis. I'm personally absolutely focused on making sure the financial system looks after the interests of consumers. And if there is bad behavior like this again, then we're going to be even tougher than
and faster, maybe.
Well, I mean, the nature of this is that of these inquiries absolutely is. I mean, I do want to be fast, but you do have to investigate problems carefully, and these things take time. But look, I
know there's law in the offing around this, but
yeah.
Will any individual be held responsible for what happened in KBC? Because like you, then their group CEO last year basically saying this thing is annoying us. This like
yeah.
their attitude clearly hasn't changed.
You may recall what I said in response to that, which is that we may carry on annoying him because yeah. he was finding yeah. us annoying. Well, the new rules which the government has committed to bring into play will make that sort of individual accountability much sharper and also more transparent to the public. We've got inquiries that are ongoing, which I wouldn't want to prejudice by talking too much about it. But the new rules, certainly, which the central bank supports, will make a big difference here.
Okay, listen, Gabriel McClough, there's a lot more we could talk about, but maybe we'll do that again. Gabriel McClough, Governor of the Central Bank, thank you very much, and we'll take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.